This is an ABC podcast.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Good afternoon. Welcome to The Country Hour. I'm Cassie Huff. How's your seeding program looking? It's well underway across South Australia, but dribs and drabs of rain in the last week or so. Hopefully you're getting some if you need it. I'd be interested to know if you're putting in canola, though, because it's looking like it's going to be a pretty hot commodity again this year, if the market's anything to go by.
There's not much standing between canola and high prices. France is looking not great. Canada is still looking pretty dry. Ukraine's probably unavailable for the next couple of months. It's all really good news.
That is good news, given what it's going to cost to get it to being repped at the end of the year, but hopefully these prices stick around. But I'd be interested to know, have you really swung towards canola this year? I know that Viterra has taken in a huge amount of canola in the past 6 months or so. So maybe a bit longer now, actually. But it's certainly been a hot commodity for the last year or so, and I'd be interested to know if that's continuing. Text me 0467 922891. Also, a slow-release drench capsule given to more than 2 million sheep around the country each year has been discontinued. I'll tell you why soon. But first up in the program, the National Farmers Federation has been keeping track of the major parties' policy commitments during the election. And there are differences opening up on things like instant asset write-offs, the live sheep trade and biosecurity funding. Michael Condon started by asking NFF President Fiona Simpson about the two major parties' position on the ag visa.
Labor is going to do a reworked Pacific Islander scheme, really, a Pacific Labor scheme, and they're going to make some tweaks to that scheme, which are very welcome from what we understand there to be. And the Pacific scheme has always been incredibly important to agriculture, but it is not going to look at extending the ag visa or taking on the ag visa to the countries that the coalition has been working on and working very hard on. Countries like Vietnam, for example, which have signed up to the initial scheme. So our concerns about that are that whilst we welcome and really appreciate the Pacific scheme and want to engage and tweak that and keep improving that scheme because it's been important to not just our Pacific neighbours but also to farmers who've been using it for many years now. We also see the need, and before COVID it was really obvious that we needed to cast the net wider when we were looking for workers, and so that we could cast the net wider to countries like Vietnam, for example, potentially Indonesia, Thailand, to countries that perhaps there was a win-win for workers to come to our country to do some of the jobs that we have here, whilst also, of course, you know, filling those jobs here in our country. We've been working on it for many years. We've got to the point now we've been disappointed where we haven't been able to get workers on the ground yet through that ag visa, but we're sort of right at the pointy end now, and Labor's saying they're not going to support. So that's been really disappointing.
So you think that even though we don't have any workers on that scheme, which is Labor has pointed out from in terms of Little Proud's ag visa, you think that given more time, it could still work?
Well, we know that Vietnam has just signed up. Mm. Once we've actually had the agreement signed with one country, then we feel much more confident that other countries may well follow suit. And of course, this is in conjunction with continuing to encourage Australian workers on the farms too, Michael, which is something else we've been working on over the last few years particularly, and you know, are now rolling out and looking at through schemes like Ag Career Start, for example, and other schemes where we're encouraging Australian workers to be on our farms too. It's a complex issue. We need absolutely every tool in the kit. The Ag Visa was one of those important tools. We feel that we've been working on it really, you know, from an industry perspective for many years now. We've got to the pointy end. We've got a country to sign up. And we think we should be now all systems go. Let's keep improving. Let's keep giving people confidence about working on farms. Let's keep engaging with industry and government and these other countries to find as many workers as we need to fulfil the needs going forward.
I gather the NFF disappointed with Labor's intention to end live sheep exports and saying they're bowing to pressure from radical extremists there, you think?
Yes, look, that's been a really disappointing announcement by Labor, and certainly one that our industry has taken on board. Look, they haven't indicated a time frame for that, and we're encouraged that they have indicated that they will listen to the science. This is an industry that has changed absolutely comprehensively over the last few years in many, many ways. So we're encouraged that they say that they will talk to industry, that they will listen to the science, they will listen to the data, and yet we have still this commitment that they want to phase this industry out and say that it's in decline, which we feel, again, is really not correct at all.
Now, the Coalition has said it's not going to continue the instant asset write-off after 2023. You're not happy with that?
No, hugely disappointing. This has been, this wasn't an initiative that came in at COVID at all. There's been some misrepresentation.
Yeah, that's what the Coalition's been saying after the event, isn't it?
Yeah, no, it came in 2015, I think it was, Michael, well before COVID. So I don't think they're quite right on that one. And not just for agriculture, but for rural and regional communities too, for small and medium businesses right across Australia. This has been a huge opportunity for us to expand and to update our machinery, to update our small assets that we have on farm. And so it's been disappointing that the Coalition, whilst they haven't absolutely said that they're going to rule it out, they've certainly used some weasel words in there, and we're not sure what they're going to do with that instant asset model.
And Labor, just to be clear, hasn't indicated its position as yet on that?
No, they haven't either. So, you know, again, it's a bit of like a lot of these policy announcements, Michael, Labor has indicated on many of them that they're happy to talk to industry, which is encouraging, and they've sort of declined to rule many things in or out, and they've said they're open to the conversation. The Coalition, I think, has been relying on the fact that we've worked well with them in the past, and that there are certainly some initiatives that we've been following through their leadership that have helped our industry. But overall, I think, and people can go online, they can download, www.timetothrive.com.au to get the full scorecard. But I think overall, we were really looking at some support for some of the big game-changing policy ideas that we'd put forward, that our members had worked on, around regional growth, around sustainability, around our workforce, around competition laws, and around connectivity. And we haven't seen, even though each and every party, I think, has indicated their support for our industry. Unfortunately, we've seen these sorts of, piecemeal announcements, bits and pieces that we've put together in our scorecard and has sort of indicated why, the score has ended up as it has. But we're disappointed not to have seen this embracing of some of the absolutely massive policy shifts that we're going to need in Australia to make the most of our path towards 2030.
That was Fiona Simpson from the National Farmers Federation speaking to Michael Condon about what's really cropped up from the major parties as it relates to agriculture, and a few things there discussed: the instant asset write-offs, the live sheep trade, and biosecurity funding as well. Now, as I was saying just before, canola is booming once again. Timely rain and some incredibly good prices are encouraging many growers across the country to plant as much canola seed as possible this season. Last year, 2.9 million hectares of canola was harvested across New South Wales, Victoria, South Australia and Western Australia, and it's estimated that 3.3 million hectares has been sown to canola so far this year as well. Andrew Whitelaw is a market analyst with Thomas Elder Markets. He says at current prices, canola is irresistible.
When we look at markets, we're really looking for price incentives. Like, what is the incentive to grow wool? What is the incentive to grow sheep meat? Or in this case, what is the incentive to grow canola? And look, I remember talking to you this time last year about how fantastic the canola price was, and it was probably around about $800 a ton. Now for the coming harvest, we're talking closer to $1,200 a ton. And bearing in mind that traditionally, $600 a ton was a good price. So that is a pretty good incentive for farmers who have got the moisture to think about planting canola. And that's what we're starting to see, huge acreages.
And so what are the factors at play behind that price, driving that price when you take a look around the world?
Look, it's a long sort of convoluted flow of events. But really, first of all, it started off, the real drive was last year's drought in Canada. That really pushed things higher. And then since then, in recent times, we've had the invasion of Ukraine by Russia. You know, Ukraine is a major exporter of things like sunflower, but also rapeseed. And then you've got sort of political events. Indonesia has banned the export of palm oil. So you've got an environment where vegetable oils, and I'm talking about things like soybeans, palm, cottonseed, sunflower oils, and canola, are all in quite short supply. So we're seeing extremely high prices. And if you've got high prices, that encourages people to plant.
Well, they're sort of the factors at play for this season. Do you see any major changes, doing a little crystal ball gazing, do you see any major changes in terms of those kind of key world factors changing in any way in the next season, so next year?
Look, next season is a long horizon away. There is an old saying in markets that high prices are the cure for high prices. So if we see too much getting planted around the world, we could see a reduction. And we're talking for next year's planting, like 2023 planting. But the reality is, if we're looking at this current harvest coming, there's not much standing between canola and high prices. There's not much that can happen for us to see canola prices drop considerably. And that is a good news sort of story for Australian farmers, because we are going to have one of the best crops, comparatively speaking, to other parts of the world. France is looking not great. Canada is still looking pretty dry. Ukraine's probably unavailable for the next couple of months. It's all really good news. And that is what is meaning that, you know, farmers are willing to plant it. And look, if you talk to anyone in a seed company who sells canola seed, if they could get more seed, they would have buyers lining up. And anecdotally, I spoke to a farmer in South Australia who grows very little canola normally. In the first week of sowing, he said, oh, I'm going to do 200 hectares. That's a big program for me. He had some seed left over and the market rose. And now he's at 400 hectares. And bearing in mind that 200 hectares is a lot for him. So people are growing it. And that should be good for the margins, touch wood.
And that's despite the, you know, very high input costs at the moment. It's certainly not putting growers off.
It doesn't seem to be. Like that, and that is the big risk that we see from the whole marketplace at the moment is the cost price squeeze. We've got high costs, you know, probably close to record costs on things like diesel, labour, chemicals and fertiliser. So the big four inputs that you have into a cropping farm. They're all expensive. Machinery is expensive as well if you want to get new stuff. And so that is the concern is over the coming years, is that if market prices for the output, you know, for the canola or wheat drops, then that really is a squeeze on the margins of farmers in Australia. So that is our number one concern. But we think this year, touch wood, fingers crossed, weather permitting, all going well, that we will see good margins this year. It's next year and the year beyond where we could see, you know, issues arising. But that's a long way away. Let's just enjoy it while we've got it.
Market analyst Andrew Whitelaw is speaking with Belinda Barashgeti. Just needs some rain to get it to grow. I'll have weather very soon, though. It is 18 minutes past 12.
Australia Votes.
For the latest on the federal election, go to ABC News Digital.
Policy announcements and how they impact you.
Profiles of every electorate, including yours.
Attney Green's Guide to the Key Seats.
You Ask, We Answer is back, and you can see what other Australians are asking.
There's our new Get Ready to Vote checklist, plus live blogs and notifications so you won't miss a thing.
For election news that matters to you, go to abc.net.au/AustraliaVotes or download the ABC News app.
You're listening to Cassie Huff on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
A slow-release drench capsule given to more than 2 million sheep around the country each year is being discontinued by its manufacturer. Dynamax drench capsules are placed down the throat of animals and sit in the stomach, slowly releasing Drench over 100 days. Manufacturer Boehringer Ingelheim declined an interview but confirmed in a statement that the capsules would be phased out by the end of the year. Dr. Andrew Whale, who is a livestock vet in Victoria, says the capsules are widely used, particularly in high rainfall areas.
So I think they're reasonably popular. I think that the number is about 2 million doses or capsules are sold annually. And I guess our, what do we talk about, sort of 60 to 70 million adult sheep in Australia. So it's a relatively small section of the market, but it's sort of used. They're used quite a lot in higher rainfall areas where the risk of worms is far more significant. And the question of what it means, I don't think it's disastrous. I think people will need to really change their ways in terms of how they manage animals without having a long-acting capsule. And I guess for everyone's understanding, it's, what a capsule does is it gives you sort of 90 days of protection against worms. So we get continual doses of anthelmintics given to a sheep over a 90-day period. So you don't have to continue to bring the animals into the yards. It's the capsule breaks down over that period and you're continually treating the animal. So they're a really effective way of minimising worm damage in sheep that are out at pasture in high worm environments.
Okay, so the capsule, it goes down the sheep's throat, sits in their stomach and slowly releases the Drench product?
Exactly, yep. It's a slow release over time and very, very effective. People have been able to administer this product prior to lambing and know that they've got 90 days where the sheep cannot succumb to worms, which is really valuable. I mean, you think about that, they might give that 30 days prior to lambing and essentially you get 60 days after lambing and the sheep are essentially worm-free and the pastures are relatively clean at that point because you've also had 90 days of very low levels of egg output from the sheep. So then you can also get another 30 or 40 days before a Drench is needed. So the 90 to 100 days of Drench effectiveness plus another 30 to 40 on top of that, essentially it's 4 to 5 months where sheep don't need a Drench, which, you know, again, high rainfall environments gives people really good confidence that from, you know, July through to November, there's no need for sheep to be yarded to be drenched.
Are there any other products that provide ongoing control or anything else being developed that may be able to replace this option?
There's capsules in New Zealand that there's potential that they could be brought over to Australia, but they'll have to go through all the registration process, like through the APVMA, which is likely to be 2 to 3 years, and very expensive for the company to do that. So, look, I don't believe there's a plan for that to be something that happens at this stage. Of course, that could change, but my understanding is it's most likely that we will not have capsules coming into the country in Australia in the, you know, the medium term at least. Now, there is a long-acting moxidectin, so that gives about half the length of coverage. So it's 50 days protection as opposed to the 90, but it is single-active, whereas a capsule, the Dynamax capsule, is actually a dual-active. So I guess, you know, our view is that it's an inferior product to the Dynamax capsule, but it still really helps people get through that that high challenge period. And I think it'll be a really useful part of people's Drench regimes that have probably relied on capsules for a long time.
Andrew, I have heard some anecdotes about where the capsules, in the process of getting them down the sheep's throat, they haven't been applied properly. I think perhaps they may have pierced or blocked the sheep's esophagus and the sheep has died from that. Have you heard of instances of that, and do you think that could be a reason behind the discontinuation?
Absolutely. We've seen lots of issues of this over the past. I guess often it's very small numbers of sheep within a mob that are affected, but there has been cases where it's been a significant mortality. It is operator error when this happens. Essentially, a capsule sits in the stomach. For it to get into the stomach, the animal needs to swallow it. You sort of pass it into the esophagus and the animal swallows it. But if you're forceful with that, you can do exactly as you said, and you can penetrate and put a hole in the esophagus and the animal, you know, sadly dies of septicemia over the next 3 to 4 days. So do I think it's part of the reason it's being discontinued? No, I don't believe so, from what I've been told.
Has the manufacturer communicated the discontinuation to you?
Yeah, they have. I've spoken to them and they've said that they are no longer continuing to supply the product. And I think it's largely, my understanding, due to sourcing the ingredients and getting it made. I think they've been having trouble actually getting the product made in a consistent manner.
Livestock vet Dr. Andrew Whale speaking with Angus Verley there about those slow-release drench capsules that are going to be discontinued. It's a bit of a problem, it sounds, for people in high rainfall areas. Speaking of high rainfall areas, it doesn't seem like South Australia really is at the moment, but Jenny Horvat, senior forecaster at the Bureau of Meteorology, can tell us what's going on this week weather-wise. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Cassie.
What are you seeing on the radar?
Yeah, look, we're not seeing too much. There's still a little bit of activity, mostly around the southern agricultural area. We saw some falls, mostly around the Mount Lofty ranges in the previous 24 hours up until 9 a.m, getting sort of around the 10 millimetre mark there around Blair and Crafers. Elsewhere, didn't fare so well. Up in around the southeast, that Pathway 3 millimetres, Robe up to nearly 5 millimetres, Edithburg sort of around the 4 millimetres. Elsewhere, it was generally around 2 or 3 millimetres or less, and it was very hit and miss with the showers, with the front coming through. We've got another bit of a front that'll clip the southeast later, so it might enhance some of the showers there again, but we're not expecting much more than a couple of millimetres with that as well. And then we will see those showers about that southern agricultural area really easing back on the Wednesday, and really just the southern coast and clearing by Thursday. We are starting to see some moisture maybe develop up in our far northwest today. Just got a low pressure system out over WA, and we're going to feed in some of that moisture. And we will look at that moisture moving bit more to the east on Wednesday and Thursday. So we're probably looking at those showers by Thursday extending to the sort of northern and western parts. If I drew a line from Juna to Arkaroola, with a good chance to see some very high chance of showers or even tending to rain at parts around the northwest of the state. We will see that unfortunately not come across to the east, but sort of linger around the WA border on Friday west of, say, Ceduna before clearing back. Looks like Saturday will be a generally dry day throughout the state, but we could start to see some moisture coming back across the west on the Sunday and then slowly extending across the east on Monday and Tuesday. So we'll watch this space to see how that system evolves. But having a look at the one out in the west, we could see some more interesting totals with that. So we are looking at sort of in the northern western parts of the state, so that sort of north and west of a line of Ceduna to Arkaroola, we could be seeing falls generally of 1 to 5 metres, and further west seeing 5 to 15, and maybe even with some of those rain periods in the northwest and some thunderstorm activity near the WA border on Wednesday and Thursday, we could be seeing falls adding up to 15 to 30 millimetres. Unfortunately, we're not seeing that come across the agricultural area this time, Cassie, but just sort of having a look at the outlooks, we are generally looking at rainfall to be slightly above the medium for the SA, but generally near average around our southeast. So our southeast really has been missing out with some of those totals, and we have remained above average across some central and northeastern parts of SA during April there, Cassie. So
you mean temperature-wise?
Yeah. Oh, rainfall-wise. So. Oh, okay. So, yeah, it's just a bit interesting that we're not really seeing that rainfall pattern coming across our traditional agricultural areas, but we've been seeing with the effect of the La Nina, with that rainfall really coming across from the tropics, and really more about our pastoral districts have really been faring a bit better, and maybe out west hasn't done as bad. But unfortunately, we have been remaining relatively dry in the southeast, and it looks like only sort of average for the outlook for them for the next couple of months as well. So we'll just have to see how we go with our winter front. So yeah, it hasn't really been that traditional break in the season that we normally see there, Cassie.
No, and sort of blocking highs like last year as well. Is that going to continue?
Yeah, look, at least for this week as well, we've got that big high pressure system sitting over the south of the state as well, and we've got this little front that will clip today, but yeah, the high remaining the dominant feature for the week, and not letting that trough really come across from the west, where we will be seeing that moisture hanging around in the north west of the state, and maybe seeing some more significant falls, which would be useful across the agricultural area.
Oh, the rain just wants to fall over southern Queensland, northern New South Wales at the moment.
Yeah, that's right. And we are seeing some good falls out in WA with that trough. And like I said, we'll see some more significant rainfall around the northwest, but not pushing further to the southeast or the east.
Thanks for that. Ginny Horvat from the Bureau of Meteorology. In the far west of New South Wales, the upper western will be partly cloudy. Overnight will get down to 7 to 10 degrees, but the daytime temperatures will reach 19. The lower western will be partly cloudy. Overnight, 5 to 8 degrees, but the day reaching up to 18 degrees. More to come on The Country Hour. I'm Cassie Huff. It's coming up to 12:30.
You're listening to The Country Hour. For more stories from across the country, go to abc.net.au/rural. On ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill, this is Cassie Huff. Cassie Huff.
Hello, it's great to have your company today. It seems the authors of a new book have stirred up once again land use commentary on what is the best way to use land, and it's suggesting a massive cut to meat consumption in Australia. But with all the work being done in that sector, will that actually make a difference?
And we don't want to be losing species. But this is a broader issue about all of us knowing more about how we sustainably support biodiversity in a range of species. And it's fine to quote those numbers, but what they should also do is look at who's making the most progress in solving the problem, and it's the agriculture sector that's doing that.
I'll have more on the debate that this book that's just been written, Food in a Planetary Emergency, has stirred up. But in the meantime, we'll find out what's making news with Wendy Glamachek. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Cassie. In the news this hour, the Coalition plans to improve the budget bottom line over the next 4 years if it retains office by roughly $1 billion by driving down spending on the public service. The Treasurer, Josh Frydenberg, says an increased efficiency dividend placed on public service agencies would raise more than $2 billion. Labor says if it wins, it will force the public service to spend less on consultants. South Australia has recorded 3,773 new cases of COVID-19, and two women with the virus have died. One was in her 80s and the second in her 90s. There are 246 people with COVID in hospital and 26,000 known active cases in the state. Police say a pedestrian's been hit by a train at the Alberton railway station. The boom gates are down at the Fussell Place crossing and trains have been stopped in both directions. And it appears low-income families are bearing the brunt of a baby formula shortage across the US, as some people have managed to stockpile or bulk buy the products on sell them for inflated prices. Shelves have been stripped bare of baby formula as ongoing supply issues combined with a recent safety recall. The Biden administration has moved to reopen the largest domestic manufacturing plant and increase imports from overseas. More ABC News at 1 o'clock.
Thanks for that, Wendy. Now, are you a pensioner and you've perhaps heard about the worker shortage, particularly in agriculture, picking fruit and things like that, and thought, I'm fit, I'm healthy, maybe I could give it a go and help out just for a short amount of time, but found that it's a bit tricky because you've got to justify your income and things like that, and perhaps it's difficult to get around. Well, this issue has been a perennial issue for agriculture. There's a constant call for regional businesses to fill job vacancies, and skilled migrants and backpackers have often been called upon. But national candidate in the federal seat of Barker, Jonathan Peet, tells Matt Stevens about his party's proposal to meet the labour shortage using older Australians.
Matt, the proposal that the South Australian Nationals put forward this week was that we increase the ability of pensioners to work while retaining their pension without the current very high level of docking that occurs to their pension. Once they work more than about 1.5 days a week on average, so at the moment a pensioner loses 50 cents in the dollar off their pension as soon as they go over that time. And when you add tax into that, that essentially means that they're working, if they choose to, for about 30 cents in the dollar that they earn after that roughly day and a half.
But hasn't this idea been floated before and had a pretty lukewarm response from the federal government?
Well, it's something that I'm very keen to push forward as the Nationals candidate in Barker, and South Australian Nationals keen to push. We think it fills that hole that's been particularly created by backpackers not being in the vicinity after COVID, and gives pensioners an opportunity to supplement their income. Now, the proposal we're putting forward is a two-tier proposal that encourages and incentivises people to come to the regions, and that would enable further work to occur if they were in a regional postcode.
So how many jobs could seniors potentially fill? Isn't it only a fraction of the overall figure?
Well, look, what we're looking at here is for those seasonal jobs, those harvest jobs that people struggle to get quality staff for. So I think the Nationals federally have been pushing the ag visa, which is a fantastic idea, which will deal with some structural full-time positions. But this is really about filling those temporary jobs that allows pensioners to still be in retirement but come out for those periods of time and work. At the moment, one in five pensioners would like to be in the job market, about 20%, and only about 3% are.
Right. So aren't we assuming here that seniors, and I don't want to be disrespectful here, but for the jobs that you're talking about particularly, that they're fit and able to carry out those particular jobs?
Look, certainly some of the regional jobs we're talking about, absolutely. But I know many people in those situations who'd be quite keen to pick up a few extra weeks' work beyond what they're able to, but can't because there's no financial benefit to them doing so whatsoever.
So is there a want from people who have retired to get back into the workforce and do some work?
Absolutely, absolutely. It creates that flexibility. I've spoken to some people in the southeast, quite a few people actually recently, that would be keen on this, and also people that are very hesitant with working out what their retirement plans look like because of the detriment should they choose to go on the pension and then trying to get back into the workforce.
Federal seat of Barker, Nationals candidate Jonathan Peach speaking. Peach speaking with Matt Stevens. I'd be interested to know if you'd be keen on that idea. Text me on 0467 922 891 or phone 1300 222 891. The authors of a new book are looking at the impact of food production on the environment and are calling for a massive cut to meat consumption in Australia. Professor Dora Marinova is an expert in sustainability at Curtin University, and she told David Claughton agriculture is responsible for the loss of two-thirds of the wildlife over the past 50 years because of land clearing.
There is a strong connection because of the land clearing, the clearing of native vegetation, and that's triggered mainly by the fact that we need the land either for grazing of livestock or alternatively to produce feed for livestock. So that's a very inefficient, or I would even say irrational, way of feeding population, because rather than growing the grain and the foods that we need directly for human consumption, what we are doing, we are growing feed and grains that are fed to the animals, to the livestock animals, and then we're eating these animals. And in the case of beef, it takes about 38 calories fed to the animal to eat, to produce one calorie for human consumption. So that's very, very inefficient. And beef is particularly inefficient. It's better when we look at poultry. It's probably 10 to 1. But still, this is not a wise way to use the planet. And to be able to produce all this feed and also to allow animals to graze, we're destroying some of the most precious resources, including the rainforest, the savannas in Brazil, as well as in Australia. We're clearing massive areas of native vegetation.
How bad do you think Australian agriculture is compared to the rest of the world? Because a lot of work is being done here to try and reduce the impact of agriculture.
Yes, we are looking at some innovative solutions such as seaweed, which can impact. The other thing that we are also looking at is regenerative agriculture, allows different way of using the land by rotating on a smaller sections. All these are good ideas and they will have a positive impact on the environment. However, what is really impossible is to maintain the current high levels of consumption, and Australia has one of the highest in the world with these new methods. So
consumption of beef, you mean, or of livestock?
Yeah, we have the highest in beef. We're very close to one of the highest in terms of overall meat consumption. What we have noticed in Australia lately is that there is a shift with increasing awareness about climate change. There is a shift towards preferences for poultry. So beef has decreased, but meat consumption has increased overall because people are shifting to poultry, which has a low environmental impact. There are other problems associated with poultry, which relate to the use of antibiotics, but the environmental impact is smaller.
So you're suggesting flexitarianism, a diet that's comprised mainly of plant-based foods, but doesn't cut out any food group necessarily. How big a change do you think is required in the diets of Australians to make that effective?
There was a report produced by the Eat Lancet Commission 2 years ago, 3 years ago now, which suggested that Australians needed to cut 80 to 90% of our meat consumption.
That's a big number.
It's a huge number. And what is even very particular about Australia is that we associate meat consumption in our culture with strength, with masculinity, with expression of our cultural identity, which is not the case in many other places around the world. So such a transition in Australia will be much more difficult than, for example, countries such as China, where there is a long tradition in using tofu-based proteins. Well, we are so addicted to meat that for us it has to be a conscientious decision by the consumer to cut so much of their meat consumption. So what I think is that there is hope, particularly with the young people who have been so proactive around climate change, with climate strikes, and with their increasing awareness about the environmental problems that they will inherit, they are willing to reduce their meat consumption. And what's quite interesting about the young generation, and we've looked particularly at Generation Z, people born after 1995, is that they are quite keen to try to increase their consumption of plant-based, traditional plant-based foods, such as fruit and vegetables and legumes and nuts and tubers. But they are more hesitant to go to alternatives proteins, despite the fact that this industry is essentially booming, including in Australia.
Professor Dora Marinova from Curtin University speaking about her book, Food in a Planetary Emergency. Meat and Livestock, though, has responded to the authors of the book, describing the work as lazy and out of date. CEO Jason Strong told David Claughton that land clearing has been a big issue in Australia and Brazil, but that the beef industry here has reversed that trend and people are working on turning things around in the Amazon as well.
Well, it's incredibly lazy and it's incredibly irresponsible. So there's arguments about the Brazilian rainforest, absolutely. And we know the destruction of the rainforest is terrible. And there's a whole bunch of people putting massive efforts into doing something about that in Brazil. They also forget that a whole bunch of that deforestation is for soybeans. And it's not for soybeans for cattle, it's for soybeans for humans. So yes, it's bad, but people are trying to do something about it. And it's not actually all about cattle. But more to the point, it's completely different to Australia. So total woody vegetation in Australia between 1991 and 2019 has actually increased. Now, that's not deforestation. That's reforesting. It's maintaining and improving the forestation of our country.
What are you talking about there?
Talking about sustainable ag, but even more broadly, it's not clearing land, and it's how we manage the woody vegetation that we have, so trees and regrowth. So it's not clearing that land in the same way that it's been cleared before and managing the regrowth in a sustainable way.
Pretty marginal, though, isn't it? Is that making much of a difference?
It is making a difference, yeah, because by stopping doing something which was a significant contributor makes a huge difference. But more to the point, the land that is being used for livestock production particularly is being used in a sustainable way. So what we're knowing, we're learning about soil carbon sequestration, for example. So using trees to capture carbon, that's very important. But also, as we increase the productivity of our livestock land area, the ability of fast-growing subtropical pastures, for example, to sequester carbon is also really significant. So we end up with the livestock sector not only being a fantastic source of
high quality food and protein, but also contributing to improving the planet as well.
But it's hard to dispute this figure that they give about the impact of agriculture on wildlife across the planet. They're saying it's agriculture is responsible for the loss of 2/3 of the planet's wildlife over the last 50 years. There have been massive changes to the landscape, and that when we do have the highest extinction of species rate in the world in Australia.
So, you know, those numbers are really scary, aren't they? You know, and we don't want to be losing species. But this is a broader issue about all of us knowing more about how we sustainably support biodiversity in a range of species. And it's fine to quote those numbers, but what they should also do is look at who's making the most progress in solving the problem, and it's the agriculture sector that's doing that.
How confident are you that the meat industry in particular, agriculture more broadly, can help bring back or preserve the species that remain on the planet?
100% confident. 100% confident.
Based on what?
But they're one of the only sectors that can. So many of the arguments that get thrown at the red meat sector, and let's talk about biodiversity, for example. You know, being able to utilise and regenerate land through the interaction of livestock and, you know, soil and pastures is one of the most productive and effective ways to, you know, promote and improve biodiversity. And there's a whole bunch of evidence growing all over the world about that. And it's not just regenerative agriculture, it's sustainable agriculture. It's about, you know, using livestock and their interaction with the land and pasture and you know, trees and others to actually not only improve productivity but also improve and maintain biodiversity. And there's really good examples of that being demonstrated, not just in research environments, but in commercial environments as well, where there's cattle and livestock producers that are demonstrating, you know, the increase in biodiversity in their production systems at the same time as they're increasing productivity and profitability by the way that they manage their pastures, their waterways, their tree and grass cover, and a range of other things. So absolutely, livestock are part of the solution. And we're one of the only industries that already has the evidence. So since 2005, we've reduced the emissions produced by the Australian livestock industry by 57%.
CEO of Meat and Livestock Australia, Jason Strong, speaking there. A couple of texts in on working as a pensioner. Text in saying, definitely pensioners should be able to work more before affecting the pension, not just in agriculture, but everywhere. However, Ryan says, I know many people in the pension who think going back to work is a crazy idea. So keep your text coming, 0467 922 891. Also had a text in saying that I hope my tax dollars didn't help fund that professor's work on that article. It is 14 minutes to one.
My fellow Australians, right now everyone wants to buy your vote. So we're back to show you how your democracy is being sold and bring you all the inside information of how the pollies are trying to spin it to win it. Join our panel of experts, insiders, and me, your election guide, Will Anthony Green.
Gruen Nation, this Wednesday night from 8 on ABC TV or log in to stream on ABC iView. Spoken by Will Anderson and the voiceover guy who has to do this bit as fast as possible.
You're listening to Cassie Huff on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Talking about food production and the environment, and one element that has received a lot of attention over the last few years for producing emissions is not cars and factories, but livestock, especially cows. They do contribute to releasing methane gas when they break wind and when they burp, actually. I think burping is the one of the main issues. But seaweed is emerging as a possible way of dealing with that. I mean, the federal government has just provided funding for a native seaweed production facility at Arno Bay, close to $4 million, I believe. Also, the CSIRO found that when the low doses of a bioactive derived from the common Australian red Asparagopsis seaweed, methane emissions are significantly reduced. So that's certainly on the radar for a lot of livestock industries. And now the Aussie company Ruminate co-founder David Messina says that early trials show that inorganic lab-grown bioactive seaweed can also reduce methane emissions from cattle by up to 95%.
Look, it is very exciting. The key intellectual property that we've developed is the ability to stabilise the bioactives themselves. And then once that has been done, we've been able to then deliver it in a whole range of different ways, from an oil, a solid, and we're currently working on a slow-release formulation. So taking that pharmaceutical approach has given us an enormous amount of flexibility.
So correct me if I'm wrong, but is the bioactive you're looking at using, is that synthesised? Is it's not coming naturally from seaweed that's producing it in the ocean?
Oh, that's correct.
And from my understanding, at the moment, it's not possible to put synthetically produced bioactives into the feed and put it straight to the livestock. You'll need to get some form of an exemption, won't you, to allow that to happen?
Look, where we've got to with our first product is because we're being able to precisely dose, we're actually at below drinking water standards. So from a safety perspective, we're very confident that we'll be able to manage any regulatory requirements or other requirements as we develop this product further.
But I gather if you're successful with what you're doing with your continuing trial work, and if you're able to get the okay to feed this form of feed to livestock, it could actually mean that you'll be able to bypass the whole aquaculture side of things, won't you?
Look, certainly with what we're developing, that is been a major focus for us. But as I'm sure you would know, the challenge that producers are facing is enormous, and we believe there needs to be a whole range of different products available to farmers and producers so that they can actually choose which particular product suits their farming system. So over time, we expect that not only will there be organic products available that are showing, you know, really exciting results, but there'll be a range of inorganic products. And ours will be one of those, and hopefully there'll be many others, because one thing about production systems, particularly that involve animals, is that there's a high amount of variation. And so it's about farmers having the ability to have a choice.
And do you think there will be a market for both?
I don't think there's any doubt that there'll be a market for both and many others, just because of that very complex and variable nature in those production systems.
I suppose the advantage of producing the bioactive from the seaweed grown in the beautiful oceans of Western Australia is you can do some magnificent marketing campaigns on where that feed comes from to be able to reduce the methane emissions.
Look, I think there's going to be advantages with, as I said, with both the organic and the inorganic product. The inorganic product and the pharmaceutical approach gives us enormous amounts of flexibility in delivering different products, whether that be water soluble, whether that be products on a pallet, in a pallet, or in a slow release formulation, so that the animals can be dosed over a much longer period with one application.
One of your big advantages, I would imagine, is going to be cost. If you don't have to produce the bioactive from the seaweed and figure out how to grow the seaweed, how to harvest it, store it, process it, etc., transport it to the processing facilities, which could be in other states, you're going to be saving a huge amount of money, aren't you?
Yes, there's certainly going to be efficiencies in all those areas, and that almost always is then reflected in the cost of the product to the farmer. And that is certainly going to be an advantage with a non-organic product, as we've seen in almost every other industry.
Do you think it'll be difficult getting the green light to be able to feed that inorganic product to the livestock, though?
Look, I think it's no different a process to any others, any other either medical or pharmaceutical products that go into those industries now. It's about doing the work, which we're about to embark on now with animal trials, to show both that it works as effectively as comparable products, but also obviously has the same levels or better from a safety perspective.
So what do your early trials actually tell you?
Look, the early results that we're finding in the laboratory have been very, very consistent, and I think that's a reflection of the precise dosing that we can do with a pharmaceutical product compared to any other. And we're seeing, you know, results, you know, above 95% in methane production in that work to date. So we're entering a period now of the animal trials, very confident that the product works. And a lot of that work has obviously been done historically. So now it's about, for us, coming up with a method of delivery that can easily be adopted by farmers so we improve the uptake as quickly as possible.
David Messina, Managing Director of the WA-based company Ruminate, and that was launched in Perth yesterday. And their first real animal trials will start next week with cattle. But Mr. Messina says it could be a few years before a methane-reducing feed supplement is commercially available. And Caroline from Moorgate has questions how you'd feed seaweed to cattle living in the outback far from feedlots. Probably a quite difficult to do that, but if you'd like to find out more about that story, you can go online to abc.net.au to find out more. Finally today, the Riverland is set to have its own commercial-scale organic composting facility thanks to a $900,000 taxpayer-funded grant program between the federal and state governments. Pete's group, who already has several facilities across the state, is considering Renmark for their new site. Managing Director Peter Wadowitz tells Eliza Berlage establishing a facility in the region will help the company reduce emissions from transport while benefiting farmers with local mulch.
Yeah, it's an exciting program. It's for us to buy equipment. So we've bought grinders and screeners and a front-end loader. And it's also to set up on its site up there.
Where would the waste be coming from that you would be composting at this facility?
So it's going to come from all the tree and branches that the councils get. It's also going to be from the green bins, the green organic recycling bins. But it also can come from any commercial waste that currently may go to landfill, any of the fruit growers or any of that material, that the leaf and branches of trees, all that material can be composted up and then returned to the agriculture in a really high organic form.
Do you have any estimation at this stage about just how much organic matter you might be able to be inputting per year?
Look, it's very, very loose, because what you find is once the facility's set up, it tracks so much more material that wasn't even counted or didn't. So there's estimated that possibly about 5,000 to 10,000 tonne.
Just how valuable is this for farmers, and how are they able to get access to this product once you're set up here?
Well, we currently supply a lot of material to the viticulture industry, and it's so valuable because we're finding some viticulturalists that are saving anywhere up to 30% water. They're getting better yields, they're getting better quality, and they just don't have to put so much weedicide out into their paddocks like they used to do. The same we're doing it. So much of the material going into the potato industry. And again, those sorts of figures are very similar. Massive water savings. They also reduce their fertiliser quantities because the cation exchange capacity holds the fertiliser in the soil where the plants, the root system is. And so they get so much more benefit from organic material being in there for water, for actual fertiliser reduction, and they're getting better yields and better qualities as well. If you look at all the almond industry and the nut industry, the plantings that are going on, they're literally planting in sand. And if they added all this organic material, they can potentially save so much water and fertiliser. And I was up in the Robinvale last week at a workshop of where they're putting organic matter into the almonds. And they're getting massive increases. And they're also building their carbon level up in their soil. So this is an area where, in the next, 5 to 10 years, it can change the whole horticultural industry of South Australia.
And where would this waste normally go?
Well, a lot of it is coming into us now, but it's transported down to our sites. So there's a lot of cost in transport. So what our intent is over the next 12 to 18 months is slowly reduce all that volume coming into our current yards and actually producing it up on site so that we don't actually have to transport it. Because again, as you know, that would be a CO2 emission, it goes up the atmosphere through all the transport. So what we want to try and do is eliminate any of those emissions along the process wherever we can minimise it.
Would this facility have any new jobs along with it?
Yes, over time it will. It won't probably in the first 12 months, but over time we're looking at possibly 3 to 4 people.
Wonderful. Oh, that's always good news. Full-time jobs, I imagine, as well?
Yes.
And is there any timeline on the construction of the facility yet?
Well, I think in the next 12 to 18 months.
Pete's Group Managing Director, Peter Wadowitz, speaking with Eliza Burlash. That's about all I have time for today, but hopefully that project goes well. Sonia Feldhoff has much more to say, though.
We're going to talk about significant trees today. Now, I don't know if you have one in your yard, but if you do, there's not a lot you can do about them in the sense that you're not allowed to cut them, you're not allowed to, I think you can prune them a little bit.
What is a significant tree?
It's 2 metres sort of across, 1 metre up.
So it's not the pixie fairy goblin tree that I named at home.
No, not that one. No. No, that one. But if you've got one of these, there is increasing numbers of councils are now helping out in terms of the costs if you have one. So we're going to find out about the latest council and what they're going to do. Also, you're going to meet Jean. She's 88 years old. She's been volunteering for 55 years at the same place, taking meals to people probably younger than her.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, my grandma was like, they're amazing.
Amazing. Oh, so Jean, let's celebrate people
Keep
like her.
Keep listening to hear from Jean. That's all I have time for, though. It's coming up to 1 o'clock. Time for news.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.